Hey everyone, Robin Ayoub here. I've got a really exciting conversation coming up on the Localization Fireside Chat today. This episode takes a slightly different angle, but highly relevant to our industry. I'll be sitting down with Adil Hussain. Adil is the Managing Director at Emerging Strategy, a global strategic intelligence firm that helps Fortune 500 enterprises and high growth companies navigate the obvious complex international transaction market. Adil has got an over two decades experience in advising executives on cross-border expansion, competitive intelligence, and risk mitigations. He worked extensively across Asia, Latin America, and the US in bringing data-driven and on-the-ground perspective, opinion, and advice to global businesses and solve business challenges. So why does this matter to the localization industry? Because global trade and economic shifts create language communication challenges, challenges that our industry is uniquely positioned to solve, whether it's navigating international contracts, navigating regulatory compliance, or enabling seamless cross-border communication. The language industry and the language services has a role to play and a key role to play in solving these global business problems, global business issues, and enabling global business successes. So in this episode, Adil and I dive into how businesses are adapting to trade barriers, what this means to and for the global expansion, and why language services are more critical than ever today. So join me on this fascinating conversation, and this is one of those episodes you don't want to miss. I'll see you at the episode. Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat. And welcome to another episode. Today, we're recording episode number 98. I have the honor and pleasure to have with me Adil Hussain. Adil, nice to meet you first, and welcome to the conversation.
Thanks, Robin. Great to be here.
Adil is the Managing Director of Emerging Strategy. And Emerging Strategy is a global strategic intelligence company that is based in the US. And I see there is a connection here between this conversation that we're having today about talking about cross-border transactions and information sharing and businesses moving between countries and the intrinsic connection with the language industry. And why is that? It's because for us in the language industry, it is important to facilitate those kinds of conversation or those kinds of interactions regardless of which country they happen to be in. So it's very timely, and I already started working on the thumbnail for this one. So it should be very interesting, especially in the discussion of tariffs and cross-border regulations, maybe tightening, those kinds of things. So Adil, before we get started, would you mind telling the audience a little bit of an introduction about yourself?
Sure, absolutely. So I started Emerging Strategy almost 20 years ago, because at the time I was doing strategy consulting, working in the US for a spin-off from BCG, and noticed that many of our clients were increasingly looking for an understanding of market opportunities in East Asia, in the emerging markets there, especially in China, but also other markets, didn't really have great ways to access the kind of granular market intel that they really needed to make good decisions. So I was young, I didn't feel I had much to lose. So I just saw the business opportunity and jumped right into it. Moved to China at the age of 27, without ever having been there before. I didn't know anybody there. And just went there and started setting up a business. That 1 or 2 year experiment turned out well. So ended up spending a decade there. Then spent a few years in Southeast Asia out of Singapore, growing our business in that region, and then returned to the US a few years ago. So I'm based in the DC area now.
Excellent. And Emerging Strategy, like if this is where it's based right now, do you like operate in a physical headquarter or you run a virtual company?
Yeah.
How many staff do you have? Consultants,
sure.
Experts?
Yeah, absolutely. So we operated a fairly traditional business model with offices in Shanghai and Singapore and the US and Mexico until COVID, and then started to hire people in other markets where we didn't have offices, and then eventually realized that half or more than half our staff weren't located in markets where we had an office or planned to have any offices, and then decided to close down our physical offices and become a virtual organization. So we're fully virtual today. We have a full-time team of about 25 to 30 people spread out across 14 time zones, ranging from Taiwan and China in the east, all the way to Brazil and Mexico in the west, and lots of points in between. So it's great every single day that I'm talking to my team. I'm interacting with people from, you know, 6 or 10 different countries. I love it.
And for you, that's truly a global company, the way you're describing it. You know, it does, you know, we think of global companies being like the big 800-pound gorilla kind of companies, but normally that's how, you know, perception is on the outside. But you see entrepreneurs such as yourself who started early, took the courage and made the jump and started something. The company now is existing in many countries. Are you covering, as you mentioned, 14 different time zones? That must be exciting for you.
So I can't take credit for coining this term. I don't know who did, but I describe our business as a micro multinational. So,
micro multinational. I'm going to remember that. That's the new term. Comes to this channel, micro multinational. I love this one. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. So on the global expansion side, in your opinion, can you give us an idea, like before we dig into the technicalities of it, who would use your services? Like in general, who would come to you and say, hey, Adel, I need you to help me out?
Yeah. It's usually large enterprises that already have significant international presence and are looking to understand how to further grow in those markets, launch new products and services, gain market share, acquire perhaps, you know, new customers, move into adjacent areas, things like that. So I would say that's the largest portion of our business. We also work with some mid-market companies as well as some startups that are looking to, maybe they've raised funding recently, and part of that is about growing their international business or something like that. And so we also work with some of those companies, but I would say the majority are generally the kind of Fortune 1000 type of companies.
And you know, for those who don't use these types of services, and I'm thinking in my mind here, like there are many companies that probably never thought about using a company such as yours. What are the pitfalls if they don't?
Well, you know, it's about finding that clarity in the chaos and the complexity. And so large organizations tend to have a fairly structured decision-making process when they're making big bets. And especially if they're public, they need to be able to defend those bets at some point, whether it's on an earnings call or something else. And so the days of using gut feel or calling a few friends and saying, hey, you know, what do you think? Should I enter this country or not? Those days are long gone. Today, the currency is really all about data, deep understanding. And unfortunately, you know, there are a lot of businesses that don't invest or maybe don't have the resources to invest in that type of rigorous analysis before they jump in or before they make big bets.
That would be risk exposure, isn't it? That would be like increasing the risk exposure.
That's right. And, you know, sometimes people ask about, well, what are some case studies of, you know, how many billions of dollars have you helped companies make? And we have. We've helped our clients make a lot of money by finding opportunities. But at the same time, we've also helped many of them avoid costly mistakes. And it's hard to tally that up, but it's about saying, well, look, this is perhaps not the best fit for you, and here's why. Mm-hmm. And having the evidence to back that up as well. So it's not only about making money, it can also be about saving money and you know, making sure that you're really
avoiding pitfalls, probably.
That's right.
Like for those, I just want to say that, put it out there, for those who are new to this, to your company, and they never heard of it before, your website, I went on your website, it sounds like it's very rich in business cases, case studies, variety of markets, variety of industry sectors. It's very interesting for somebody who want to get to know your organization, just to get a taste of it.
I
love the way you structured your website, and that's just me, because somebody from the outside, first they say, you know, they look at a brochure website thinking, doesn't tell me much. But your website digs really deep into the heart of the matter. It says, you want to get to know us? read a little bit about some of our business cases, which is great. Kudos for that.
Thanks. It's a constant work in progress. So I think it's just something we're always working on. How can we tell that story better and make it easier for people to understand exactly what we do?
Yeah, there's a saying that says, the fruit is in the pudding, and you put that out there. People, instead of saying, demonstrate, you're showing them before you can actually, my background is sales and marketing. So show me what you can do and show me you can do it well. So moving right along, I'm sure there is based on the last discussion that we've had, if you can expand on the idea of the balance between standardizing your global strategy as a business versus localizing it to the market that you're in. And I'm sure you advise on that all the time. So how do you see that? I mean, you've got a large organization. You mentioned you work with many of them. They're probably from a cost perspective that would like to standardize and put everything into a central location. But meanwhile, the local market is asking them, hey, I want something different. How do you manage that? And how do you advise on that?
Yeah, great question. So I would think of the 70-30 rule. So standardize.
You're 80-20, right?
Right. I'm a big fan of the Pareto principle. I love 80-20.
Okay.
But here we're going to talk about 70-30.
Okay.
So for international expansion, I think you're standardizing 70%, which is around your core brand, product, global identity, and really want to localize 30%, pricing, distribution, consumer experience, customer experience. And of course, sometimes even the product may need to be localized. So that's roughly how we think of it. Now, for some real world examples or case studies, I'm going to use, and as we go through our conversation today, Robin, I'm going to refer to case studies of companies that most of you've probably heard of. So more consumer facing types of businesses, although a lot of our work is with companies that are more B2B and are somewhat more obscure and niche. But I'm just going to give you an example right now about Netflix in India, right? So when Netflix entered the Indian market in 2016, they had their US style pricing, $6 or $10 per month, something like that. And at the same time, their local competitors were offering essentially freemium or ad-supported models. So it took them 3 years to figure out what to do about this, but eventually, in 2019, they launched a $3 a month mobile-only plan, which at that time at least was, half or less than half the price of their cheapest global plan. They also aggressively localized their content, right? So in India, you're looking at, besides Hindi and English, you're also looking at Tamil, you're also looking at Telugu, other major regional languages, and then productions like Sacred Games and Delhi Crime. So that is that 30%. So it's not about changing the core value proposition of Netflix, right? The brand, it's a streaming service, all of that, all you can eat, all of that is true. But they had to localize certain elements of that. And so within a couple of years of making these changes, they were able to grow their India subscriber base by about 60%, making it one of their fastest growing markets.
Wow, what a success story. And I live in Canada, obviously, and I pay for Netflix. I just posted something on X the other day. I received my Netflix price increase notification, and in Canada now we're paying close to $19, is $18 in some sense. But I love the example that you gave, because if the economics in that region does not support a American North American prices. And I remember the same conversation we've had with a market research firms when you do those, global surveys and try to survey different demographics around the world. You have to adapt these surveys to different countries. For instance, one of the biggest questions, I guess, on some of the surveys, what is your annual salary, for instance? And they, the drop-down menu starts, let's say, at $25,000, $30,000 US dollars, and then it goes all the way from there in terms of the amount of money you make per year, an individual who's filling out the surveys. And then when those surveys are published, let's say in India, in the Middle East or in Africa or whatever it is, $25,000 is a dream. Maybe like you know, that would be like considered completely off the mark in terms of where we fit.
That, so that would be the top end. That would be the top end of the drop-down.
You probably have to adapt that, don't you?
Right. Yeah. And look, we use the tools of market research every day. You know, a lot of the work we do is informed by very rigorous market research. What I'm seeing right now is AI is making these adaptations in survey design and so forth so much easier to manage, where in the past, we really had to spend a lot more time in, if you're doing a multi-country study, we had to spend a lot of time in localizing all these tools, whereas now we can create one standard form and then use AI to make a lot of those variations and then, of course, review and make some final tweaks. But it's made it a lot more convenient.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about AI. I'm glad you addressed it. But the question here on the market research, you do your own market research or you outsource it?
Yeah. No, we do our own market research. We use tools like, you know, surveys, interviews with customers, interviews with other market participants, experts, competitors.
Do you do focus group as well, Adil?
Yeah. Less so. Most of our conversations tend to be more one-on-one. We find that the kind of subject matter we're talking to people about is better in that setting.
Okay. Now, I want to ask you, general question here regarding the current status of what's going on in the U.S., the new administration, and how is that impacting your business? Are your customers speaking to you a little differently now? Are they bringing to you, you know, different projects that you've never seen before? How is that impacting you?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot going on. And so never a dull moment, especially with this administration. I think for a lot of businesses, they're looking for some more clarity. You know, I find that most businesses can actually be quite resilient when they know what they have to deal with. What businesses don't like is uncertainty. So whatever the tariffs are or whatever the, you know, particular sort of issues are, once they become clear and there's some way to predict that this will be so for the next, you know, whatever X number of months or years or whatever, at that point, I think businesses can make some changes to the way they operate and move on, get along with things. Right now, a lot of businesses are just sort of frozen because there's a pronouncement about tariffs and then, you know, a day before the deadline, something changes and then something else goes on. So this is a fairly chaotic situation and it is becoming hard for businesses to make, forget long-term plans, even sort of medium-term plans.
Okay. And is your company in touch like with government officials and do you do lobbying? How do you get the sense of what's going on the public side of the policy side?
Yeah.
So you can apply it to your business.
So our business is strictly focused on the commercial aspects. We don't do public policy and lobbying and government affairs work. There are firms that specialize in that. So we do, of course, have to be informed about what the policies are and what their impacts are going to be on business. But the research we do, the original research we do is quite focused around understanding the commercial, kind of the market participants rather than the regulatory type of issues.
So just to bring it down home for somebody, right? So let's say I'm a company based in Singapore. I'm interested in, you know, opening a new market or adding a new product to an existing market in the U.S., and the biggest question for me would be is geography. And the second is the risk associated with my decision, basically. And that's where you come in with answers, I'm assuming.
Yeah. So I like to use this very, nice framework, which I refer to as where to play, how to win. It's actually two steps out of five from something that's more complex called the strategy cascade. The former CEO of Procter & Gamble, A.G. Lafley, came up with this framework. But where to play, how to win is a lot of what we do. Figuring out which markets, in this case, it could be geographic. In other cases, it could be, you know, some other definition of a market, maybe a vertical or whatever, or customer segment. So where should our clients be placing their bets, making their investments, and being able to do that with confidence? And then the how to win is really about informing go-to-market strategy. So questions of pricing and channels and partnerships and in some cases, even mergers and acquisitions. So those are the two sort of big buckets of the work that we do.
Now, one of the biggest question, I guess, and you touched on it a little earlier, is risk mitigation, right? So in terms of risk mitigation, I'm assuming you provide information that allows you to see down the road kind of thing in terms of managing the risks, et cetera. As you mentioned earlier, things are changing quite quickly, meaning that the information you're providing has to be fluid and agile to a large extent. But take an example, for instance, most businesses carry, you know, just as they worry about many things, but one of the item that people worry about or business worry about is currency fluctuation. Just give us an example how and what are the type of risks. You know, I mentioned currency, but it must be like many others.
Sure. Yeah, so supply chains are under a lot of stress when you're in an environment of uncertainty on, you know, about global trade. So that's a big focus of risk mitigation right now, especially if you're in any kind of manufacturing related business. There's a risk mitigation around, you know, which countries you can do business with to comply with your clients or your regulatory sort of compliance, you know, issues. So, well, things may change, who knows, but, you know, as things currently stand, you know, Russia and Belarus and North Korea and some of these places. So you have to sort of make sure that you're not, you know, running afoul of those kind of things. So we're not necessarily the experts in all aspects of understanding and managing international risk. That's a really big area, and it falls into lots of different, very specialized roles. The area that we really specialize in is understanding markets, customers, competitors, and how to sort of win in a competitive market, how to gain share, how to get attention, how to dislodge existing competitors who might be local, who might be other multinationals. That's really where we specialize.
So you're really down to the, you know, what they call the mechanics of doing the actual business. You know, who's your competitor if you bring this product in? What's your, you know, you need to worry about? Those are really tactical items that the business worry about. So the higher level items that I was just talking about, you advise on them. You probably tell your customers, here, you should be talking to this person. I'm not your best person in this case, or I'm not your best company in this case, but we help you in understanding the lay of the land when it comes to how do you market your product here in whatever region. Speaking of markets, what's your read now? Like, what do you feel the regions that there are, or industries around the world that there, you think they're going to be the big hotspots right now?
So I think that there's still a lot of additional growth potential in emerging and frontier markets. And when you see countries generally move up the income ladder, people start paying more attention to and spending more on, because they have the ability to, on services around health and education and consumer products and so forth. So I take an overall long-term, highly optimistic view, where I think that there's a lot of additional potential in emerging markets around the world. And so I would overall, again, in the longer term view, be fairly bullish about those types of sectors. The decade that I spent in China, I saw firsthand the significant sort of, you know, improvements in lifestyle that people had, and not just in tier one cities like Shanghai, where I lived, also in China has a system of classifying cities by tier. And so, you know, I had the fortune to travel extensively in the country, including to tier five and tier six country cities. And so you could really tell the difference in terms of the development, in terms of like the access to the products and services in even these fairly small towns by Chinese standards. Maybe it's a large city by Canadian standards. But I think that overall, I think there's still a lot more runway. There's a lot more growth potential there.
And what do you feel like, you know, there's a lot of unrest right now in the world, right? So if you look around, there's hot spots from a conflict and, you know, countries opposing each other, and that creates in some cases, it takes those markets offline, if I can say that, in some cases. And, you know, when these things calm down, it sort of puts that market back online. I hate to think that way, but Is there an opportunity there?
Yeah, great point. So, I mean, right now you have flashpoints in Eastern Europe, in the Middle East, potentially in East Asia, South China Sea, Taiwan. But there's still a lot of business happening in all of these regions. So I think a lot of businesses will price in something like a risk-adjusted return if they feel that there's still, despite that modeling of risk, still an upside that is attractive, they'll still go for it.
Have you ever worked with a company in the localization industry? Have any one of our companies came to you and say, hey, I would like to expand globally? Help.
No, that's interesting. No, we haven't worked with them directly as a customer. But the work that you all do, it's very much part of the same ecosystem. And I would suspect that in most cases, it happens maybe a little bit more downstream from where we sit. Okay. So once companies have made a decision about where they're going to go, where to play and how to win and all of that, mm-hmm. and then they move towards more of the execution side where they need to then actually localize the product or make those local websites for marketing purposes or communications. That's probably where you all get involved. But have you found it any different? Have you found there to be any kind of upstream sort of engagements as well?
Yeah, look, I mean, generally speaking, our industry is an afterthought, and you bring a very valid point. Like, we're way downstream in terms of where we fit before this strategy gets crystallized. But I was thinking more like, you know, like every industry, we have the 80-20 rules. 80% of the industry revenue is, you know, concentrated at the top 20 companies. I was wondering, any one of our industry top players, have they worked with your organization to figure out how to expand or get some advice on the industry?
No, but if anybody is listening that wants to,
that's why I'm asking.
Yeah, happy to.
That's why I'm asking, because most of our, and it's just like the nature of our business, right? So, you know, you've got a small company working out of Argentina, for instance, covering, I don't know, 200, 300 languages. They need resources in all these countries. So the nature of the business is global. Like, you don't have to convince anybody to go hire somebody in another country, because it's the driver for that, right? So that's why I was interested in the question. Now, you mentioned earlier like something about AI, and I was wondering, what's your read on your business vis-a-vis AI? Is it, do you always see a human involved? Do you see a, you know, 80-20 rules? You know, how much involvement for a human? And now, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years down the road, what's your read?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, where we sit is in the broader sort of information space as well, right? And the information space is being rapidly disrupted by AI. I mean, even take Google as an example. I use Google a lot less now than I used to a few years ago, because I am able to go to Perplexity, for example, to ask questions and get back answers with sources that are fairly high quality. So the overall space of people being able to access information easily, conveniently, that space is changing very much. I think what AI does quite well is it detects early market signals. It can help you track trends. It can help retrieve government filings and things like that by being everywhere at once and really automating this idea of monitoring at scale.
Yeah.
Which if you're doing it in a very human-centric way, that can be very expensive and labor-intensive. So, for example, scanning regulatory updates in multiple languages in, you know, 50 countries around the world in seconds, something that would take an analyst quite a long time to do. Where I think AI has limitations, at least for now, is bringing the human context. At the end of the day, until AI becomes our customer, maybe that'll happen one day. At the moment, customers are humans. And so if you're a business that's trying to understand a market, you need to engage with actual people, whether they're representing a business or whether they're consumers. And you need to be able to get some insight directly from people about how they feel about your product or service and whether they would buy it and what they'd be willing to pay and how they think of this versus other options and, you know, things like that. I don't see AI yet sort of taking over that space of primary research. But are there tools that make it easier to conduct primary research? Sure, that's happening. So at the moment, I feel that it's very much around a combination of human and AI working together to do the heavy lifting, at least in our line of work.
And you know what? It seems to be a common thread across everybody I talk to, that AI is playing a role, but it's helping. But those out there, that they have this utopia vision that AI will take over in some cases, completely 100% in its current status, if it doesn't evolve and become better. And I'm sure it's happening as we speak, but in its current status, there are a lot of human in the loop required on every job. Like if you're in the research business, or if you're an engineer, if you're a lawyer, if you are whatever job you do. And I did an episode on the knowledge base industry and the impact of AI in knowledge base industry, which covers pretty much the gamut. It's a great help. Everybody says the same thing. It's a great help. It's allowing me to do things, complex things, in a shorter time. But I still have to go over it as a human, as a professional, as an expert, just to make sure that we're not hallucinating in terms of the way we're providing our answers to our customers.
Right. I mean, even in my sort of day-to-day use of AI, you know, just for personal questions and not even like work-related necessarily, I often find myself cross-checking, sanity checking from the answers from one AI to another. So I'm the sort of a AI, I don't know anything about the programming side of AI, but I'm kind of a power user of AI, and I pay for ChatGPT and Perplexity and Claude and probably, you know, three other things as well. And so I'm often like taking the answers from here and putting it over there and saying, well, what do you think of this? This doesn't make any sense. And then I take that and put it back in the other one. You know, playing them off of each other. And, you know, the answers are often different. And so it gives me an ability to then say, well, are you hallucinating? Like, is this nonsense?
It sounds to me like, if, you know, I can just visualize and picture it in my mind that, you know, I've got all these AI models out there running, and everyone in them, you know, pretending to be like the better and the best. I just see them in my mind, like a robot, bunch of them, like the robots in the room fighting with each other, and you can do a video game out of it. So maybe somebody's working on this now. So, but the evolution of AI, it's like, this is the scary part. You know, my background is computer science, and I've always been intrigued in this. And I recently started coding again, just as a hobby, you know, just a few things here and there, just to play around, just to stay sharp. And the amazing part from my perspective is how quickly, like, I have not coded for about 30 years. And to come back to it now, I wouldn't have been able to do it without AI. AI allowed me to go back to it. Why? It's because it brought back all the what I've learned and demonstrated it to me in a very, if I wanted to ask a question, I could ask a question. If I write a code that is not, I don't think it's right, AI can tell me, oh, this is right, this is wrong. And it tells me, like, the learning that I gained from that in a very short time, it was incredible. Otherwise, I would have probably had to go back to some school somewhere and learn it, or online, and do that. But I did it in the comfort of my home, and it took me like a couple of days.
Yeah. So I think it's definitely reducing the number of human hours needed to do certain things. And, you know, on the one hand, you can look at it as improving productivity, which is certainly true. But reduction in human hours could also mean reduction in services you need from other people. So in the past, if you would have gone to a programmer for certain, you know, you might be able to do some of that low-hanging fruit yourself and maybe need fewer hours, less time from another professional. So I think it's disrupting any kind of knowledge or services-based business. It's got to be disrupting that space.
Absolutely. So tell me, what's next for emerging strategy? Like, what's your vision?
Well, you know, we're not going to rest until every business has access to the best intelligence around how to succeed internationally. So, you know, I want to grow the business in terms of its influence and impact in international commerce. I think I mentioned a little bit earlier, I'm a bit of an optimist and idealist as well. I think that cross-border business, cross-border commerce really plays a very important role in bringing people together and driving some kind of common shared interest as well, which can hold us together as humanity. So it might seem a little bit lofty to say, well, market advisory and market intelligence is somehow doing that. But I would like to think that helping companies make better and more informed decisions that allow them to do more business internationally is part of that. And yeah. so that's sort of the idealistic, you know, fulfilling part of what we do. And on a personal level, like I said, I really enjoy working with people from around the world on a daily basis.
That must be amazing. I experience it also in my job. I'm always talking to people, like, just the nature of our work. You know, a couple more things for you. One is, do you have a sales strategy in place? You mentioned growth earlier. Is there like a sales and marketing strategy in place? Do you have a team that helps you? And second, and the third is your strategy, you know, rely on organic, meaning I go get a customer and or alliances, maybe I build partnerships or maybe white labeling your services to somebody else. Like, how do you manage, how do you partner?
Yeah, great questions. So, you know, I was reading this book about professional services, business development, and they outlined there are three kinds of consulting firms out there, right? There are firms that the services they provide are evergreen in nature. So that's your CPA, etc. If a client doesn't hire this firm, they'll hire somebody else, but they kind of need those kinds of firms all the time to check the box or just to basically do compliance. The second kind of consulting firm is the one that is an acute service provider. So when shit hits the fan, you need them. So that's your cybersecurity firm that comes in and, you know, fixes a breach, or your bankruptcy lawyer, or, you know, whatever, right? So you don't need them all the time.
Clean up crew.
Hopefully you don't need them all the time, but when you need them, you need them. And then the third bucket are the discretionary providers, right? Where you have limited ability to drive demand. You have to wait for the client to be ready to take action, and then you can step in and help them. And I think a lot of what we do probably falls into that bucket. So business development for us is really more about being seen and heard, being visible, so that when a client has that need, they think of us and hopefully, you know, give us a call or send us an email and say, hey, you know, we spoke, or I read this thing you wrote or whatever, and I want to talk about it. But we have limited levers, I feel, to create a need where the client themselves don't know that it's not like that movie Inception where you can go into somebody's head and sort of make them do something.
No. The need has to be there, and somebody has to realize, I've got a problem. I need a solution.
That's right.
For them to come in. And but you're right about building connections, though, and being visible in front of your potential customers.
Yeah.
Because you don't know if they have a need now, and they may have a need tomorrow or 2 years from now. But if they have your business card or they remember your name, they'll probably reach out to you.
Yeah. And you asked about partnerships. So that's actually one of our more recent initiatives.
Yeah.
Because, you know, just like us, there are lots of other service providers that are also involved in the general sort of ecosystem of international business, international growth, et cetera. And, you know, it's possible that in some cases we may overlap a little bit with each other, but in many cases, the services are quite distinct. And I feel that there are opportunities to refer business back and forth as well. So something we're paying a lot more attention to at the moment is deliberately reaching out and making connections with other providers, even if they are unrelated to our services.
Mm-hmm.
We also do white label some of the work we do. So larger consulting firms reach out to us from time to time and ask us to work on specific initiatives, providing either the research or even beyond that, maybe in a market where they don't have direct presence or expertise. So we're happy to cooperate in those ways as well.
Yeah. And, you know, I probably mentioned this before, but I repeat it again, even though we're recording. I will introduce you to a good friend of mine from Atlanta, and I think there is room for cooperation there. So I'll put an introduction out for you.
All right.
On LinkedIn, and hope for the best. So I try to help our guests as much as I can, where I can. So, and if I can help you in any way, even, you know, after the recording and everybody goes home and your viewers goes through the roof on this podcast, hopefully, if you need me for anything, just hit me up and I'll be happy to support you in any way I can.
Thank you, Robin. Appreciate that very much.
Yeah, no problem. So just before we wrap it up, I guess one final question for me is, you know, if you were to advise somebody or a company who are planning internationally, like, what is the one piece of advice you'll give them?
Well, what works at home won't necessarily work abroad. The companies that are most successful internationally are not necessarily the biggest or the ones with the deepest pockets. They're actually the ones that are the fastest learners. So that learning ability and the ability to take that learning and apply it to your approach, to your business, that's actually what differentiates, I feel, the most successful companies in the international space. Adaptability can beat size. It's why Amazon now is doing quite well in India, while Walmart struggled for a long time.
Absolutely. And you know what? Adaptability and learning new markets is absolutely crazy important, right? You know, I've seen several examples here in Canada. We had Target come to Canada and it didn't work, right? So they left. Lowe's came to Canada. They bought an existing company in Canada. They bought Rona from Quebec. And that company now, it's been rebranded again to Lowe's. They tried to run under the Lowe's brand. It did not work. And so all their stores now, and they closed many of them. They kept a few. And they renamed them all to Rona. Two things, like if you have to operate in a culture of sort, you have to understand the culture and all of its dynamics.
Yeah. So, you know, we're talking about big box here. One of the examples that I saw right in front of me in China in the period that I was there was Best Buy. So Best Buy entered China thinking it could replicate that big box retail model from the US, but really ignored local shopping habits. You know, Chinese consumers really preferred neighborhood electronic stores or trusted online platforms like JD and Taobao and so on. And then they also mispriced their products. Some of the local competitors were offering the same brands at lower prices. And I think 5-7 years, something like that, after they entered the market, they were gone. They closed down all the stores and moved on.
True. So I want to thank you. I mean, as we wrap this up, we're coming to a time here. I want to thank you for joining me today, Adil. It was really enlightening for me to have this conversation with you. And I'm sure the audience would like it. And watch out for other items that we're going to be putting out there. So the way it works is we'll put the video out on YouTube. We'll put the audio portion on all the podcasting, favorite podcasting channels. And we'll also put a blog post summarizing the conversation on the blog site as well. So first, thank you so much for joining me today. And I want to leave you with the last comments.
Thank you for having me, Robin. This is an absolute pleasure. I'm sure that there are listeners here who have more questions. And if I can help in any way, please hit me up on LinkedIn or through our website. Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Absolutely. Anytime. And you're welcome back to the channel anytime. Consider it yours.
Thank you.
Anytime you have a new idea or you want to bring up a new concept that you like to put out there, happy to help you out. And thank you so much from me and Adil to the rest of the audience. Thank you very much for listening, and I appreciate you following us on YouTube and all the other channels that we have. Please share, like, and comment on our content. It helps me quite a bit, and I do this voluntarily. Nobody pays me to do it, so I just putting it out there. All I need from you is just to engage the content. That's all I need. Thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your day. Bye, everybody.